Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutun.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Coral reefs of Malaysia are some of the most biodiverse ecosystems on the planet, covering more than 4,000 square kilometers and containing some 550 species, and that's the ones that have been recorded. So what is needed to ensure that we address and reverse some of the threats impacting our coral reef ecosystems? Joining us on the show today is marine ecologist Sebastian Saradoy. He's the founder of Coral Coo, which is a social enterprise for coral reef restoration and conservation in Malaysia. Sebastian, thank you for joining us. I understand that you have been researching in Malaysia for the last 6 years. Can I ask you what you have observed about the condition of our coral reefs, particularly in recent times?
In Malaysia, I've actually had the pleasure to witness a great amount of biodiversity. I had some stunning marine life encounters as well, but the first thing that I noted compared to other regions of the world where I had the pleasure to visit is that the abundance is missing. So if you put that into perspective, is that you do see a large amount of diversity. So species of sharks, sea turtles, all kinds of creatures, they live in the coral reef, but you do not see them in great abundance. So I'm talking about Peninsular Malaysia. And I spoke to a few villagers in Kampung Merang in Terengganu, and they told me about all the great shark sightings that they had in the past 30, 40 years ago. And that really gave me the first introduction to what the Terengganu archipelago used to look like. But in particular, during my time in Terengganu and working on the coral reefs, I think 2019 it really sticks out as a year of observations in terms of what our human impact is on the reef. And I think I need to walk you through it in a time frame, in a timely order. Because when I got back after the monsoon season in February, I visited our best reef. And in January, you might notice Tropical Storm Pabuk crossed through Terengganu, which was a very unusual event because usually tropical cyclones that do not really pass through the northern part of Peninsular Malaysia. And the devastation that caused to coral reefs in Redang Island, Perhentian, and also in Langteng Island, where I'm based, was tremendous. Entire coral reef sites were degraded, reduced to rubble, and even buried by sand. And that was just the first part of what was yet to come during that year. Later that year, I saw mass coral bleaching, which is due to climate change. And throughout the year, we saw a lot of different impacts. For instance, after Pabuk, infrastructure, wooden jetties had collapsed on coral reefs, which caused a lot of damage. We had an outbreak of coral-eating snails. That sounds very absurd, but we had thousands and thousands of coral snails eating away the reef, which is very unnatural and most likely relates back to overfishing and sewage discharge into coral reefs. So if people ask me what is your greatest contribution to coral reef conservation in Malaysia, I would say, well, I killed about 20,000 coral snails, and that sounds very absurd, but that reef would be history by now. So 2019 was really one of those years where I noticed the reefs in Malaysia are extraordinary. As you said, they are very diverse. There's a lot of beauty. They are highly important to the local economy, but I was reminded very clearly that there is a lot of bad things going on that we need to address urgently.
Right, and urgency is actually in some sense the subtext of your article in Makaranga, the environmental website. It's the piece that you wrote, Now or Never for Malaysian Coral Reefs. Could you help us understand that? I know that environmentalists tend to speak in this way. Their detractors accuse them of alarmism. But could you give us a sense of perspective? Why is it now or never? I mean, what exactly is the window of opportunity that we have now to reverse or at least mitigate the damage to our coral reefs?
That's a very good point you're making, because when we speak as environmentalists or conservationist people, we always speak about problems, and we always speak about problems like they are the end of the world, and people tend to get scared by that, and it sounds very negative. And it's very difficult to communicate the urgency behind issues without tipping onto that side where you speak very negatively about it and you really discourage people because you just overload them with bad news. And it does sound like alarmism, but the truth is, especially for coral reefs, the amount of heating, of temperature heating that we've seen in the ocean the past 35 years is incredible. And the International Panel on Climate Change came out with a report earlier this year, and they literally said we have 8 to 10 years with climate change and the climate crisis before it's going to get really, really bad. And it disappeared out of the news. And so there you go. You have world leading researchers at the end of their careers or in the middle of their careers who really do not have to gain much from making such big statements and are also arguing within the reasoning and objectivity of science. And they're all saying the same thing. We have 8 to 10 years. And what I've seen personally, I just spoke about 2019 as a mass coral bleaching event, which is an immediate result of climate change. In 2020, it happened again, which was the first time ever in Peninsular Malaysia that happened in back-to-back years. And what's very important to note here is that 2019 was an El Niño year. So in El Niño years, you have hotter and drier climate. 2020 was a La Niña year. And it's supposed to be cooler. It's supposed to be wet. And there shouldn't be any coral bleaching or any marine heat waves. We had two marine heat waves between April and September that year. And actually, on average, that time frame, so April to September is the hottest time in Peninsular Malaysia, was the second hottest since 1985. Which is when satellite monitoring really improved, and we have access to that data. Everybody has access to that data. Okay. And it was the second hottest on average. So that's the urgency. It's really happening tremendously quick, tremendously fast, and the consequences are really severe.
Well, let's talk about the consequences. Sebastian, can you shed some light as to what might be some of the consequences if we don't stem the decline of our coral reef ecosystems?
It might happen very quick, in just a couple of extreme events like Pabuk, for instance, or it might happen in a couple of consecutive marine heat waves. But altogether, if you go out and visit some of these coral reef areas in Peninsular Malaysia or anywhere really, you will find reefs in a great condition, and you will find reefs in a very bad condition. And then when you kind of visualize the differences between one and the other, you can also sort of start to understand what the consequences may be. I think the first to suffer would be the tourism industry, because they lose the aesthetical value, right? Snorkelers, divers, everybody loves to see beautiful coral reefs, everybody loves to see marine wildlife, and that brings immediate revenue to the tourism sector. Secondly, you would probably see changes in the fishing stocks and the abundance of fish that is being caught. Not just because of that, because also a lot of the fishing pressure and the methods play a role. But if you reduce the quality of the coral reef habitat, you also stand a very great chance to lose a lot of the fish stocks that you do not catch immediately in coral reefs, but further out at sea. So that's also why we have marine parks in Malaysia. And then ultimately, if you lose corals as an ecosystem, you stand to lose the most biodiverse ecosystems in the oceans. And that to me is really grave and severe, because so much depends on corals and it's all really interconnected.
So Steve, if I could just jump in there, because I want to pick up on the first point you made about tourism. But it seems to me that even in your piece, you do note that, discharge from resorts, I mean, tourists come and they bring dollars to people, but they also, because it's perhaps not managed in the best way or the most optimal way, they're themselves now part of the problem. They're polluting the very environment that in some ways their money could support and protect.
Yes, that is the case, unfortunately. And there is a lot of initiatives on the ground from various organizations and individuals, and sometimes by the tourism operators themselves, to sort of mitigate these issues. I also work with a resort, and they are being very generous. They're helping us. They're giving us access to the facilities. This is very outstanding to me. On the same beach, we have one resort, which is the one that I work with. And they have an A-class septic tank, which is really doing really filters out all the pollutants from the sewage discharge, and that is very I really applaud them for doing that, because that's very expensive. They had to invest a lot of money to do that. And then on the same beach, you have a resort which is the total opposite of that. So there's both, and some tourism operators are really stepping up, and they really start to see the changes in the environment, and they are aware of what they are doing to the environment, and they are also aware of what the environment means to their business. And some are just blatantly ignorant to that fact. And in my piece, I also said that they need to contribute back, because they are the first to profit, and they're also the first to lose. So it's really also their mission to work with conservationists and scientists to mitigate the problems.
Right. Sebastian, we're going to take a quick break, but let's come back and continue this conversation. Very important conversation about coral reef restoration and conservation in Malaysia. We will be right back on Consider This. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned. Thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation with marine ecologist Sebastian Saradoy. He is the founder of Coral Coo, which is a social enterprise for coral reef restoration and conservation in Malaysia. He's been researching coral reefs in Malaysia for the past 6 years. I want to ask you, Sebastian, I was reading that data on coral reefs, coral reefs have not all been explored or recorded or mapped out, particularly in Malaysia. I'm wondering how that might impact conservation work, especially if we're thinking about the need for data and sufficient monitoring to measure progress or decline of coral reef ecosystems.
There is two very important aspects of having data and to having data that monitors progress. Let's just start with the first one. When I was tasked to kind of come up with a restoration idea or plan for Langtenga Island, I was looking for fundamental baseline data technically to give me an understanding of how these reefs looked like before a couple of things went wrong. And I was stunned that I could hardly find anything. And that really makes the job very difficult, because when you have to manage something, you need to know what you're up against, and you need to know a lot of different things. You need to have environmental data, you need to have ecosystem data. And I would say that Malaysian coral reefs are mapped quite well, actually, but what is missing is very detailed scientific data on how things look like and how they change and the impacts on various what we call disturbance events on those reefs. Because if you do not know, okay, well, I have a marine heat waves event and it impacts only 50 out of 100 species, you do not really know how to work, how to come up with a plan. And when you speak about coral restoration, then that's even more difficult. And that leads me to my second point. When it comes to monitoring progress, many projects and initiatives on the ground when it comes to restoring coral reefs, they do not monitor their progress. So we have very little data on what is the best practice for restoring coral reefs, what are the successes and failures, which species is doing well, and so forth. And that part is also very important, especially today, because the changes that we're seeing in the oceans are happening so quick. So we really need to be there technically every month or every year and really monitor every single bit.
Can I ask you, Sebastian, to clarify something? How can you tell if a coral reef is healthy? Is there a difference between, you know, like the slight difference between what is considered healthy and what is considered unhealthy coral reef ecosystems?
Yeah, so I guess the first indicator would be the amount of fish. Healthy coral reefs usually sustain a very high abundance of different species of fish. And the more fish, the healthier the reef, because it means that the habitat is complex, it's healthy. But sometimes even healthy reefs do not really support healthy fish populations. So you could look at things, for instance, is there a lot of algae? Is there a lot of coral rubble? Coral rubble is when the coral dies and it breaks off and it falls onto the ground. So you would see that a lot in many areas of Peninsular Malaysia. You would see just vast stretches of coral rubble. And then there's always a couple of indicators. Is there a lot of trash? is there signs of physical degradation that may have come from a boat anchor or from a discarded fishing net? And if you really want to go into the science of it, you would look into the diversity. You would look into what type of coral species, because some species are like weeds, literally, like some bushy, let's just compare it to forest, right? You have bamboo and you have very old, beautiful trees. And that's the case for corals as well. So if you have more species that are of different sizes, so young ones, older ones, so small and bigger ones, then that gives you a really good understanding. Okay, this might be a healthy reef. If you see a lot of fish around it, then that's also a very good sign. So you kind of have to know what you're looking for.
Sebastian, talking about looking, how do you think the government, the Malaysian government, and actually governments, because we have state governments and we also have the federal government, how do they view the seas? You talked about coral reefs being well mapped, but were they mapped essentially for navigational purposes, for ocean bed exploration, for oil? How does the state think about the sea, and is that part of the problem that we have?
Well, I actually have to give credit to the government in the regard that they have established marine park areas, which have very clear rules on what you cannot and can do. And recently, a survey has been circulating on how to improve the management of those marine parks, which was by the government. And a lot of these areas were actually mapped. My Malaysian colleagues have been participating in those projects to establish new marine park areas. So the information that is there is mostly there because upon invitation from the government, there was a big survey in the year 2000, which is already 22 years ago, but that's one of the fundamental pieces that everybody refers to. And since then, a lot of the mapping has been done to sort of establish new marine park areas. So a lot of the most important coral reef areas are actually protected. And I would say the government sees it in the following perspective. We have protected them. So we have made clear rules. You cannot fish, you cannot do this, you cannot do that. But that's not the end of the story. So drawing a few lines around the territory is not going to prevent problems from happening. So we also need enforcement. And enforcement is happening, but now there's so many different interests, right? Developers want to build resorts. That has to be done in a sustainable manner. Some local communities want to continue fish in their in their areas, which I completely understand that they want to do that. Then there's higher interests, such as building airports. And the government is obviously at the center of that and has to manage that and has to make decisions for everybody involved. And that's a very difficult job to do. But I would say that the government has established marine parks to protect coral reefs, which was a great first step. But now the second step needs to manage the ongoing issues that are present and the interest that may impact coral reefs negatively as well.
So how do we compare, say, to other countries? I'm just wondering because these competing interests are not particular or unique to a country like Malaysia. How do other governments look to balance the ecological impact of some of their decisions? What can perhaps Malaysia take into consideration?
I think you're absolutely right. This is not unique to Malaysia. This is actually a problem that is technically found everywhere else too. I've worked in the Maldives as well a bit, and I saw similar issues. What was different to the Maldives, the Maldivian tourism industry is the biggest contributor to the country's economy. So the resorts are technically have some sort of autonomy over their turf, so to say. So most of them run their own restoration programs. There is a great pressure coming from the tourists themselves to see that they care about the environment and so forth. But there's also countries like Australia, which have the Great Barrier Reef. That's the biggest coral reef ecosystem on the planet. You can even see it from space. Little fun fact there. The only structure built by animals that is visible from space. And the Australian government, for instance, tries to manage pollution on a great scale. They have invested in coral restoration, what they call adaptation and resilience, but they're not managing the main driver, which is threatening the Great Barrier Reef, which is greenhouse gas emissions. So they're not doing or haven't done anything much on that regard. So Malaysia is, I would say Malaysia is pretty, the situation is pretty normal. It's not necessarily overly bad. It's not very good either. But what perhaps could be better is there could be more will. Like the situation is really urgent, and the government has recently established initiatives to kind of give more autonomy to local initiatives on the ground to co-manage the reefs and allows people to do more research. But now really what needs to happen is we need to move into a coordinated phase where people work underneath the umbrella of the government in a coordinated national plan. And I think that's the way forward. And if Malaysia would do that, then that would maybe set Malaysia a bit apart from the status quo, because that status quo is not great either. Let's just be honest here. And that is something that Malaysia could do.
Okay, but Sebastian, do we have a fundamental problem? We're kind of hoping national governments will help solve what is, in fact, a planetary problem, one that requires all governments to work together to reduce, at least in attempt to reduce carbon emissions. One of the problems that you have pointed out in terms of rising sea temperatures. But, you know, we're in a situation where national governments are hemmed in. They might do very well in terms of their contribution. But if the rest of the neighborhood doesn't, then they're still going to be impacted, right? I mean, the seas don't have boundaries. So how do you deal with that problem?
That's very tricky. Malaysia on its own cannot prevent the climate from changing. That is very true. But we have to also understand that it's similar to the pandemic, right? We all kind of part of the problem. So we all need to kind of do something to help solve the problem. And it's very important to understand that Malaysia is going to be impacted by many different climate change scenarios, like increasing floods. I think that's very present at this moment. So the Malaysian government also needs to contribute to that. And I just spoke about the Australian government. They have done something very similar where they are trying to mitigate and manage everything that's sort of local, specific to Australian territory, but they're not really participating in the global agenda. So I think, this is my personal opinion, governments need to act globally and be part of that global movement, but also really, we also really need to step up locally. And because on a local scale, particularly for coral reefs, there's so much that could be better. So much of the issues are happening on a local scale. And I would argue that Malaysia has lost a lot of coral reefs, not just Malaysia, Southeast Asia, and perhaps everywhere else too, has lost a lot of corals because of impacts that have happened locally so far. And now climate change is coming in, and that is just gonna really, really be the grim reaper, so to say. So the Malaysian government needs to act first and foremost locally, regionally, but also really needs to sort of acknowledge its responsibility to act globally on climate change.
Sebastian, thank you so much for sharing those insights. That was our conversation with Sebastian Saraday. He's a coral reef ecologist. And that wraps up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, and good night. Good night.